Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. And we're going to be talking about a topic tonight. I hope you don't get too frightened by this topic. Actually, I'm going to be talking about what dying can teach us about living. I know that probably sounds a little bit scary, but I promise you our guest and guide on this topic is one of the most cheerful people I've ever had the pleasure of interacting with. So I know it's not going to be a downer, even if it sounds like it is. Her name is Becky Hawkins. And she has been compassionately aiding people to leave the planet for 30 years. That sounds like a very important job, doesn't it? She spent the heart of her career as an oncology and hospice nurse in Oklahoma. And she offers 60 tenderly rendered short recollections of those experiences that stayed with her, the ones that touched her heart. And new book that she's got. It's called Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. And you can actually get a copy of that over at LadyHawksPublishing.com. I'm really looking forward to learning some brand new stuff here. And, you know, this is the shame-free zone. A lot of times we talk about sex. We'll probably talk about that somewhere in the course of this. I do have some questions for Becky about the sexuality of terminal patients. But I also want you to be thinking about the shame that we sometimes feel about being sick, about being terminally ill, and just the ways in which culturally we kind of avoid this topic. So here in the Shame-Free Zone, we are all about taking on those big topics that we might spend the rest of our time avoiding. So let's not avoid it. Let's go into it and find out how we can probably come out the other side feeling a little more courageous and a little happier. Becky Hawkins, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Thank you so much, Veronica. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Well, and where are you located tonight? Where are you calling us from?
Northeast Oklahoma, about 45 miles northeast of Tulsa.
Oh, my. Yeah. So, Oklahoma. You know, I haven't actually been there.
Well, it's a good little spot.
Okay, well, let me ask you something. Now, you know, I have a friend, actually, who works hospice, and sometimes it's a little trying for her. She'll be working with a patient, and of course, she knows they're going to die, and then they die, and it's difficult for her sometimes to keep her emotions even. And I'm just wondering if that's ever an issue for you. And can you tell us a little bit about your path as somebody who's worked with the terminally ill?
Yes. In the beginning, whenever I first started working with my oncology patients and my hospice patients, I had to learn how to balance the work with the dying and the work with very critically ill patients, along with trying to live life and finding that balance of taking care of myself and making sure that I had what I needed to still stay engaged with life in a way that kept me healthy. And it took a while, you know, for me to figure that out and understand that. And that's why I started writing. I would come home from work and my husband would say, you know, I don't know how to help you process some of these emotions that you're feeling. Why don't you start journaling? And so that's what I did. I started writing about what I was feeling, about what they were experiencing, and what I was going through, what they were going through, and eventually started penning an article for a local newspaper called Beyond Statistics, where, of course, I kept, you know, the privacy of these patients and never did use any of their names. But I would write about their stories and their stories of what they were going through and in the process what I was learning from them. So that helped me tremendously to find more balance in what I was doing with them. And so my first article was May of 1986. And so I've got, like, you know, so many, many, many years of journaling and articles. And this past year, I put 60 of them into a book that I thought might be helpful to people to hear their stories and bless them and perhaps their own journeys in dealing with life and death. Because, Veronica, all of us are going to be there. We're either already there right now where we're at the bedside with somebody, or we've been there, or we're headed that direction. And so I'm hoping to help people understand that what we need to do is live our authentic life and not be afraid to do that, not to be afraid of who you are and where you are, and not to be afraid of transitioning.
Well, and you know, it's an interesting choice of words. Now, obviously, you must sometimes have patients who don't actually believe that there's anything on the other side of death. But do you?
Well, yes. You have some patients that are still trying to deal with where they are on this side. But a lot of people, as they begin to get closer and closer to that transitioning phase, will start to move towards, yes, where they're headed. And so many of them, and that's a lot of my book, are examples of where people are talking to me before they die and telling me what they're already seeing. A lot of them had pre-death visions that were examples would be where a sibling is coming to visit them that has passed years before, or a mother or a father or even a child that would come to visit them, angels that would come into the room and start talking, you know, and visiting with them to help them to know that they were going to be escorted and assisted, that they weren't going to be alone. So you can imagine what this did to me. This changed my spirituality concept completely.
How would you term your spirituality concept beforehand?
Well, I was raised in a Southern Baptist background, you know, very conservative. And so when I started dealing with these people that were dying, that were, you know, starting to tell me, you know, what they were seeing, you know, I thought, you know, this is way bigger than what I grew up with. Also, there were several patients, and I put this in my book too, that had had near-death experiences that would tell me about that. You know, you spend this time with people, and you really get connected to them. And as I would visit with them, I would say, are you afraid of this dying process? And some of them would say to me, no. And do you want to know why? Let me tell you about what happened to me several years ago. And they would tell me their near-death experience from whatever reason that led them to this point to know that they did not need to fear death because they were just transitioning into this next life. They knew where they were going. They knew what was going to happen. And so they were very comfortable with knowing it was okay to move forward.
Now, were all of these people, did they have a particular faith or a particular belief before these things happened, or Did any of your patients maybe could have been agnostic or atheist and then had some experience that caused them to change the way they believed?
Yes. Yes, because that's the thing. Not everybody had a set belief pattern. This is the thing. There are people all across the board, Veronica, from all over, because I started studying this, you know, after I started experiencing it, that are Christian, agnostic, atheist, Buddhist, Hindus, all over the board, that have had near-death experiences, that they are beginning to see and understand that they are transitioning into a new place where there's so much love and so much unconditional love, no matter, you know, whether you're believing in Jesus or you're believing in Buddha or you're believing in whatever, that you're understanding and moving into this new place of being totally okay. You know, just, you know, that you're so beloved and that you're so okay the way you are. I grew up believing that you had to be a certain way, that you had to be a believer of a certain set of beliefs, or that you wouldn't be okay. My brother had a near-death experience. The last chapter of my book is called My Brother's Keeper, and I was with him from his diagnosis through his chemo and his radiation and his dying experience, and I did his funeral.
Wow.
And he, like several months before, had this near-death experience where he was choking. His tumor was wrapped around his aorta, and it was into his lungs, and then they told us that we can't, you know, we can't buy you a whole lot of time, but we can buy you some. And he said, okay, I'll take it. And before we could even get into this oncology appointment the first time, we had gone to my sister's house, our sister's house, for her birthday. And on the way back, he started chilling. And I said, do you want me to get you to the hospital? And he goes, no, just get me back to Dad's. Let me get in the recliner. I'll take some Advil. If I need you, I'll call you. Well, I no more than got home than he was calling me, and he was gasping for air. And I said, okay, I hear you. I'm calling an ambulance. I'm on my way. I'll be right there. And then immediately I hung up and called my dad, who was in a different part of the house, and I said, Daddy, get into Jeffrey. He's choking. Hold him up. He may have some kind of occlusion, some kind of problem there. Just shake him. Do whatever. I've got an ambulance on the way. I'm on my way. So when I get there, the ambulance is there. My brother is sitting in the recliner, and he is purple. He's blue. And I said, are you okay? And he could look at me, and he could speak a little bit. But anyway, we got him to the hospital, got him to Tulsa, got him in the hospital there, and we were there for 10 days. And during that time, got the chemo and radiation started. And got to go back home, and of course, you know, with radiation, it's every day, and I'm driving him every day to radiation. And yeah. About two or three days into this, on the way, he taps my shoulder one day, and he said, you know, I almost died there at the house. And I just looked at him, and I said, well, no kidding. You were purple. You know, yeah, you were about gone. And he said, no, you're not hearing me. You don't understand. You know, I was dying, and I said, okay, tell me, what were you seeing? Because I've had so many patients talk to me about this, and I said, what were you seeing? And he said that he was choking, and then all of a sudden, he was out of his body in this beautiful place where it's light and it's bright, and he's just, you know, just feeling so okay. And our mother, who died in 2002, is coming towards him on one side, And on the other side is a friend of his who committed suicide a year before. And they were approaching him, and he said, oh, my God. He said, please, just give me just a little bit more time. And my mother said to him, then breathe, son, breathe. And so he said, all of a sudden, he woke up, and he was back up, back in the house at my dad's with the ambulance. And
wow.
He said, okay, what do you think about that? And I said, well, what do you think? And he said, well, I think she bought me some more time. And I said, well, you know, here we are. To see, Veronica, the gift of that was not only him seeing our mother, but to see this friend who had committed suicide. You know, growing up the way we did, we'd been told that anybody that committed suicide was going to hell. Well, because of my years of experience with these people, I don't believe in hell. But this helped me even more to understand that when someone commits suicide, they go to this beautiful place to find the healing that they need and the love that they need. And what a beautiful gift that this young man did for my brother to come to him and be at his side as he's in this transitioning process and then agrees with my mother. Yes.
Wow.
Go experience some more time.
So, and how much longer did your brother live then?
Almost a year, not quite.
Wow. How did he feel about what remained of his life? Was he did his attitude towards death change at all?
Yes, because I think it helped him to not be as fearful. He was very, very brave. He had been in AA for 15 years and was very strong and very into his relationship with God in a different way.
Right.
And he was accepting of whatever. He was not afraid. He was ready to go whenever his time came. And he was very brave. And it was a rough deal. I mean, I was with him every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
But what I experienced with that, and was so glad that he was able to share that with us, and that I could share that with my siblings and my dad, our dad, and help them to know also as well. You know, we're just laying down this clay vessel and moving into, you know, this new life. And see, that's the thing about all of these people that shared with me their near-death experience. They don't care if you believe them or not. They are so happy to be able to have had that experience because they meet death unafraid.
And how was your brother's his relationship with life? You know, so he lived for several months more. How was his relationship with life changed?
He was amazing. He just was so eager to say, you know, give me as much chemo as you can, give me as much radiation as you can. I want this time to be his daughter, my niece, lived in Kansas, and he wanted some time to be with her and her children, his grandchildren. He made peace with people that he had not had peace with before.
Mm-hmm.
He made peace with his own self, which it was wonderful for me to observe and be a part of in hanging out with him so much. He taught me so much about the whole experience. He was very, very close to our mother. There were four of us, and I'm the oldest, and he was the youngest. And to know that he had visited with our mother in that process.
I would imagine that was, I would imagine it was huge for you, too.
Yes, yes. But my mother, after she passed, I felt her presence, and I still do, in many ways. She still comes to visit me. That's the hope of my book. Is for people to understand that they don't need to fear death, that it's just a transition. But this journey here is about us learning how to love each other and care for one another and how to grow our souls. That's the thing about hanging out with dying people and people that are seriously ill. There's so much education that comes to you. When I would be present to these people and just be make myself a person that could listen and hear and be present to them. And sometimes it would come from them, or sometimes it would come from a family member or someone in the hospital that was with me in the oncology ward. There were just so many opportunities for me to listen and hear about the big picture. I was young at the very beginning of this. So,
and you had a lot of very interesting characters. For instance, there was some woman who shared her bed with a copperhead snake.
Oh, yes, bless her. You know, this was going out into what we call like the boonies for me to go see her.
Okay.
It was way out in the country, way out where I could, you know, I had to, you know, almost leave breadcrumbs to find my way out of there.
Wow.
But she was blind from her disease, and she was very precious, and I had to fight off her geese to get into the house.
Wow.
And got in there, and this precious, it's like going back into time. The walls of her little house were covered in 1940s and 1950s pictures of calendars of Jesus and different biblical characters.
Yeah.
There were holes in the floor, a potbelly stove. It was like really and truly stepping back into time. But in her mind, you know, she couldn't see. It was heaven right there where she was, her little existence. But as I'm coming into the door, she said, "I know that my geese were fighting you. I'm so sorry. Please don't hurt them because they eat the baby copperheads." And I was,
oh.
I said, "Yeah, you know." I said, "You know what? They're my new best friends. If they're eating baby copperheads, I'm going to bring them food."
Okay.
But as I'm caring for her, you know, assessing her skin because there's wounds on her that need a lot of care. And I roll her over and I'm checking her back. There is a petrified little black snake in her bed.
My God.
Been dead for a long time. And I didn't say anything to her. I just removed it as I'm removing and changing her sheets because, you know, didn't matter. And, you know, the little fella's dead. He didn't know he was going to crawl up there and be smushed and be, you know. But
wow.
What helped me to understand about this whole presence, because, you know, she was from the old world, and she said, "Could you go into my refrigerator and get a piece of fat back and put it on my heel instead of that antibiotic, because I think it'll heal me up faster."
Wow.
You know, there's just so many experiences, Veronica, that just take me in so many places that help me to understand people in so many environments and appreciate who they are, where they are, and where I am.
Wow. So you never told her about the snake then?
Yeah. You learn that it's not always like your home. It's not always like where you're existing, what you're thinking and what you're believing. But she had such a beautiful faith. She had snow white hair, blue eyes that she could not see out of very good anymore, and a spirit and a peace, you know, that passes all understanding. She was totally unafraid of dying. She was fine. She just, you know, just said, "You know, come in and do your deal. Just don't hurt my geese."
Wow. And you also worked with the Amish, and I guess they were a little afraid of you because your hair was orange or something?
Yeah, during that time I had my hair spiky and a different color almost every month or so. You know, it might be bright red, it might be maroon or whatever, and I always wear red lipstick. Yeah, I'm a wild girl. And this precious family, you know, very, very straight-laced, very Amish, welcomed me into their midst because they felt like, okay, she's got the knowledge that we need to take care of Mom.
Yeah.
But what I found when I got in there was they were doing everything that Mom needed. And I helped them understand about the tube feeding, about the wound care that she needed. And this precious mom, with me looking the way I did, looked at me and smiled. You know, she crossed beyond the belief system and received me as one who would care for her in a way that would bless her as she was blessing me. And they were so good to me and so kind to me. Because, you know, I visited with them, and you know, I told them. I said, you know, I just don't think I could do this, what you're doing. I would fail at being an Amish woman because, number one, I'm not going to go out there and wring a chicken's neck. The only thing that I think that needs a chicken's neck is a chicken. You know, I'm vegetarian, and I'm not into that. And as far as, you know, driving that tract out there, you know, if any man tried to tell me where I had to drive it, I'd be going, you know, you go over there, I'm driving it where I'm going to drive it. And they thought it was funny. You know, they laughed at me, they loved me, and I told them, see, I shared with them, I said, you know, you guys are marvelous. You know, the care that you're giving her is exceptional. There isn't a nurse that could come along and do a better job than you're doing. I said, you're phenomenal. And when she passed, these dear women got in a buggy that was pulled by a tractor and drove it to the hospital where I was and brought me a huge tray of homemade cinnamon rolls and homemade bread, homemade jellies and jams as their expression of thanks to me for acknowledging what they were doing for their mother.
Wow. It sounds like you know how to win people over.
See, and that's the thing about Earth, and that's the thing about where we're living on this Earth, is that we are one human family. Whether we are Amish, I've been to India, I've been to several places, and what I have learned, Veronica, is that we are one human family. No matter what religion we are, no matter where we're working, no matter what we're doing, we're here on this precious earth for a very short time. It's brief. My grandfather used to tell me, Becky, even if we live to be 110, it's short. It's brief. What do you want to do here? What kind of footprints do you want to leave here? What do you want people to say if they come to your funeral? How will you be remembered? And that's what these people taught me over and over and over again. You know, we need to be about caring for one another. And this is my prayer for all that's going on right now, all over this earth, is that we can come to understand we are one human family and that we need to be caring for one another. When some people come to me and they'll say, one nation under God, and I say, please, all nations under God. We are all precious, no matter where we are, no matter who we are.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that sometimes mitigates that our ability to see how we're all connected and we're all part of the same human family is if somebody's acting, you know, like a really, being a real jerk. And to quote you, you had one patient who was a SOB,
yes,
who turned out to be a gentleman, and you know, people love stories of redemption. So how did that happen? Can you tell us something about it?
Okay, this one person that I was taking care of, and I'm not sure, you know, I have so many stories. This one person that I was taking care of, that a lot of the nurses were afraid to go in and spend any time with, was an old Army veteran. And he was bleeding profusely. And my supervisor warned me ahead of time. She said, now listen, Becky. And I was young. He likes pretty nurses, and he cusses like a, you know, a blue streak. And I was going, okay. And I went in, and I saw the situation where I knew, you know, I was going to be spending a lot of my time with him trying to redress his wounds, continue his transfusions, and be present to him in the midst of what was getting ready to happen. And he was a delight. He was hilarious. He was going, hey, sunshine, where you been all my life? You know, what are you doing? What's going on? You know, let's, you know, come in here and sit with me a while. You know, I'm going to smoke this old stogie that the doctor told me I can hang on to for a little while. And don't get all holy with me telling me I can't have it either, because he said I could. You know, come over here and sit with. He goes, hey, you know what? Go get that nutrition lady downstairs that keeps coming up here to tell me I need to drink more fluids. Tell her I want some of that smoky scotch and see if she's, oh, God, that'll get her laughing. Let's do that. What do you think about that? And he was adorable. You know, he was very, very scary to look at because of everything that was going on, but he was trying to rise above the moment and be brave and continue his humor, continue his being the soldier that he was. And blessed me in the process and helped me to understand because the doctor came in and said, you know, this isn't working. We're going to have to stop the transfusions, and we just need to make you comfortable. And he was so sweet. He said, you know, Doc, you know, you're a good soldier. You know, you've helped me fight this fight okay, and God bless you, and we'll just do this, you know. We'll meet this enemy head on. There was an education for me, Veronica, in every door that I went in, every home that I went in. I wouldn't trade it for anything. People would say to me, why do you keep doing this depressing work? Are you kidding me? These people taught me about life and death. One of my favorite stories, do I have time to tell you?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
This precious little minister that I was going to see, who was dying from the damage to his heart and lungs because of radiation and chemo many years ago. And I was going to see him to try to help him prepare because his heart was failing fast and his lungs. He was married to a lady who had been one of his parishioners because his first wife had died. And she wouldn't even call him by his first name. She would just say, Brother Smith. And she was so afraid of what was happening, she would usually run and hide in the kitchen when I was trying to talk to him about how to prepare for this. So, yes, one day I got the call and said that, you know, I needed to hurry out there. And I visited with her and I said, go get the neighbor if you're afraid. I'll be there as soon as I can. And please try to remember everything I've taught you. And when I arrived, the neighbor ran as fast as she could back home, and my patient's sweet little wife ran as fast as she could back to the kitchen. But he said to me, and he was in his recliner, and he was purple and could not breathe well, Becky, can you get me to my bed? And I picked him up, and I carried him to his bed, which is by the big, beautiful window, and by the front where he can see his church, which made him very comfortable. And I set him straight up, and I crawled in behind him and straddled him and put one hand on each shoulder so he could get air better. And he patted my fingertips, and he said, Becky, do you see them? And I said, no, tell me what you're seeing. And he said, Becky, the room is full of angels now. I have to go. And he hollered out to his wife. He said, Annie, I have to go. I love you. I'll see you again.
Oh, my God.
And he raised up his right arm, and he said, oh, my Lord. And he fell back against me, and he was gone.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I just sat there for several minutes and held him. And she came back in, and she surprisingly wasn't afraid anymore. I think the fear of death was more than him being dead. that bothered her. And we were just there with him together. And see, that's the thing, because, you know, the veil is parted at that moment. And I get to be there for that, and people say, why do you do what you do? Are you kidding? To be at that holy space and place. I've told people that I feel somewhat like a midwife, because I'm there for that process of a person.
It's interesting that you just said that, because I was just thinking about the birth process, which is also when, that's when, you know, people are arriving.
Yes, but. Yes, because I'm not forcing it, and I'm not pushing it, but I'm present to it and assisting with it, and then to be there as that precious person makes that journey to the other side. I wouldn't try to
do anything. What do you see a role? I mean, you talk about how to spread warmth and positive energy when you know somebody's time is limited. If somebody out there is listening and they are in the process of losing a loved one, what would you suggest to them as far as being able to make their loved one's time remaining meaningful?
I think, Veronica, the most important thing I've learned from patients is just be present to them and let them lead you. You know, if it's months or weeks before, even days before, they sometimes will help you understand if they want you to share with them. You know, come and talk to me about when you were a child and we chased each other around the house. Come and talk to me about when we were in high school and we did that, played that dirty trick on somebody. Come and sit with me and talk to me about when your child was born. You know, they will bring us into what they want to talk about. Or they will be very straight with us and say, you know, we're not talking about this. Just be with me. Let's play some music. Let's just be still. So I honor every person, and I try to get every family to understand that too. Your life is your life. Your death is your death. Honor that with all people. Don't try to make it all about you. Yes, you are an important part of that, but understand, this is their death. Let them do this the way they want to do it. Be present to them. Bring
love. Do you find that some family members are unable to let their loved one pass the way they want?
Yes.
Can you give us a for instance?
Yes, Veronica, and that's normal, too. Sometimes I will see a group of siblings where one is very good at sitting at the bedside and all about what this loved one wants to do.
Uh-huh.
Another one is in the garage tinkering with stuff. Another one's in the yard mowing. Another one's in the kitchen cooking. And everybody is okay. And what I try to tell them is don't judge if your brother cannot come to the bedside. He's doing what is good for him to do. And this loved one who is passing understands that. Please remember, not everybody can be right there at the bedside, like maybe you can.
Mm-hmm.
And also understand, do not be hard on yourself if you cannot. Maybe you're better at the financial matters. Everybody's precious in their place and their space.
So, so it sounds to me like you're suggesting that the family members of somebody who's terminal try to honor and respect what that person expresses as their wishes, yes?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but what if the family member who is dying doesn't have a lot of ability to communicate those things? Maybe, you know, their memory is slipping or they're in a coma or whatever. I mean, it's an important.
Okay, that's a very good point, Veronica, because what we have learned over the years is that the hearing is the last sense to go. And there have been people that have been able to share with us from near-death experiences that they could hear everything that's going on in a coma. So what I tell people is anything that you think you don't want them to hear, don't be saying that at the bedside. But, you know,
okay.
They can hear you. But speak to them of your love for them. Speak to them of what they have done for you that blesses you. Speak to them of whatever you want to share with them. Because they can hear you. And we had one lady that had been in a coma for several days. The doctor called the family in and said, you know, we've just got hours here. They gathered around the bed. She had very little blood pressure. And like I said, in a coma for days, non-responsive. She sat straight up in that bed and reached towards the end of her bed and called a daughter's name who had passed.
Wow.
She was a young child.
Uh-huh.
And laid back down and was gone.
Wow.
So be respectful of that person that's in a coma that is passing and understand. Speak to them. Play the music.
So this person who was in a coma just before they died actually called out the name of a family member who had died before them.
Yes. That woman sits straight up in her bed. Right before she passed. That's the power. That's the power of that. And you can only imagine what that did for all those people standing there.
Mm-hmm.
Raymond Moody has just written a book called Shared Death Experiences that's phenomenal because people started coming to him and saying, we understand near-death experiences, but have you ever experienced this? And they would tell him his story. And one of my favorites is this family that is gathered around this loved one's bedside. She's gone.
Uh-huh.
All of a sudden, all of them with her are raised up into this environment of love and light and everything. And they are carried into her panorama of life review. And they see people that they knew long ago. They see people they don't even know that she knows and that she's talking to and carrying on with. And, you know, this whole deal. And then all of a sudden, she's moving forward, and they go back to the room. They go back to the bedside.
Hmm.
So that's huge. That's a whole new field. But what it helps us to understand is that, yes, it's real. It's so real. It's so true. And one of the ladies that came to me at the very beginning of my book, I mentioned her. Because she had a near-death experience when she was a very small child, very, very young, with polio. And she said, Becky, please tell these stories. People need to know that this is real. Please tell our stories.
Mm. And that's exactly what you're doing, is telling these stories. You had a couple that was married for 75 years?
Yes.
Now, was one of them dying or both of them? Or
No. I was just working in a nursing home as a nurse's aide. I was 19 years old and just taking care of people. And it was their anniversary. And I had gone in to take care of them and just visit with them and everything.
Uh-huh.
And I had never heard of anybody. You know, they were both of them, you know, 100 years old, like 102 and 100 and whatever.
Wow.
Yeah, and they were in their rockers, and they were still, but they were sad because all of their children had passed.
Oh, my God.
And here they are celebrating this anniversary. And to them, it was kind of okay and nice, but in a sense, sad. And I tried to make it lighter, and I said, okay, which one of you deserves the biggest crown? You know, and he couldn't hear very good, so he was pointing at her, and she started sharing with me about life and why they'd been married so long. And she said, you know, back in our day, you know, there wasn't a question of staying married. You stayed married to take care of each other so you could survive. She said, well, you know, we just did what we had to do to survive, to take care of one another. And what they gave me as a very young person, was understanding that sometimes it's not all about the years, but the quality and of what you've experienced in those years. They were glad to still be together, but they were still sad that they had lived that long and lost those children. So those people taught me a lot. They weren't even dying. And they taught me a lot. And that's what I bring in my book. You know, experiences from nursing school, where you find me under a patient's bed at one point, and that's hilarious. And then, you know, people, when I went into the nursing home, was working in the nursing home, and people that I'm meeting in the oncology ward, the hospice area, all these people all across the board that are teaching me lessons about life and about death.
And well, let's go back to the the couple that was married for 75 years. I'm curious. Now, are they in an assisted living environment?
The nursing home, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm just wondering, you know, I promised my listeners we would talk about sex at some point, and I'm curious about this particular assisted living institution. Did it embrace the sexuality of at least married couples, or did they have policies on people on dating? Or I'm just wondering, how was that?
You know, not that I remember in that particular environment, but I will tell you that when I was taking care of a hospice patient years later with a young woman who was in her 40s that had terrible disease, that this was an issue for her and her husband because she was so ill and so fragile. But they were still young, and she would ask us, you know, can you help me figure out how we can do this? Because there were a lot of physical things going on that were a compromise to the situation. And a nurse that was, I was probably in my 30s then, and this nurse that was in her 50s, she was amazing. She said, you know, Becky, you're too young for this. You know, you just need to scoot over and let me help them. And she went in, and she sat with both of them, and she talked to them exactly, Veronica, about, okay, here's what you need to do. You're going to take this medication at this time of day, and you're going to do this, and, okay, we're going to set up this time, and you guys can get with it. And then, you know, when you're done, you know, we'll come in, we'll help, you know, with all this other stuff. But I love that because she understood how to approach this in a way. Talk about shame-free. She helped them to understand this is just as important as your pain medicine. This is a part of who you are and where you are. Let's make this happen for you in the best way we can. And she did.
Have you found that that is prevalent throughout the nursing and hospice care?
I think now, later, you know, that we're seeing that more, where if a person is not, you know, real close to the dying phase, but they're in the phase where they're still able to have a desire, that they're not consumed with their pain or they're not consumed with their, you know, just being so fragile and frail and can't breathe good. You know, if they're still in a space, in a place where they are knowing that that's a vital part of their existence and their relationship with someone, then yes, it's addressed. It's not swept under the rug anymore like it was probably even before I got out of nursing school. Well, you know, you just didn't talk about, you know, you didn't talk about death. You know, you didn't talk about hardly anything. You didn't talk about pregnancy or, you know. But now, thankfully, and especially for people like you that have helped to educate people and help people to embrace, you know, where they are as they are at whatever point in their life, that you don't want to shove your sexual relationship under the rug either. You know, if that...
Well, if there is not a sexual relationship, if you're just trying to be a sexually viable human being, that can be a little difficult sometimes. I know because, you know, sometimes people feel a lot of shame around being...
Yes.
Having sexual feelings when they think that they're old, unattractive, or sick.
Right. Thank heavens that there's people like you that are trying to help people understand, educate them, and be positive about, you know, sexuality is not a bad thing. You know, being sexual is not a terrible thing. You know, it's wonderful. I was taking care of one lady. she was great. You know, she had had some whiskey and she'd had, you know, some cigarettes, and you know, she had a rough voice, but she loved me. And I went to see her one day, and I was visiting with her, and I was trying to help her with a dressing on her abdomen and talk to her. And she had that rough voice, and she said, you know, Becky, you need to move out of the way a little bit. There's a guy out there fixing my porch, and he's got a real fine body. I want to look at him.
Good for her.
So I just love that. I laughed so hard. She said, yeah, I just move over a little bit to the right. You know, she goes, damn, look at him. Doesn't he look fine?
Yes, well, we oftentimes think that people don't have those kind of, you know, that somehow or another they get too old to be thinking or feeling that way, and it's just not the case. And I think it's really important that people feel sexually viable regardless of what is happening to their health or their age.
Yes,
or
God
even their
made
ability.
Us this way. God made us this way. It's not, it's, we're, that's normal. It's normal and it's healthy. So I'm very, very grateful and thankful for somebody like you trying to help people understand that.
Thank you. And I'm relieved to hear that, at least in some of the personal experiences that you've had, the patients have felt honored. I certainly know that that's not the case in many healthcare facilities. The patients are sometimes, their sexuality is seen as kind of inconvenient. And and people are in adult people who have lived, raised children, fought wars, can be infantilized by the system at times and treated like they're children. And I think that is an insult as far as a way to go out. But I'm really glad that you are trying to put a message out there about honoring the patients. I know this is something that you stress, letting go of control, surrendering to a higher power, and trusting that everything is as it should be. Also helping, you know, a person to die the way they want to instead of the way you want them to. You also talk about embracing, you know, how to live in the present and not dwell on the past. Do you find that some people, when they're getting ready to die, can get a little morbidly focused on resentments and regrets?
There are people, yes, that have told me that they do regret that they... one gentleman told me, he said, you know, I spent so much time trying to work overtime and make money for my future retirement. He said, I wish now that I had spent some more time with my grandchildren and that I had taken my wife on trips, because all of that money that I was saving for the future is being spent on radiation and chemo and all this and hospitalization. He said, you know, I wish that I could have shown these people that I could be with them more than being with my job. And another person that told me that he wished that he hadn't been so angry at a person he had been mad at for 40 years. He said,
wow.
You know, I regret that so much. He said, that has not served me at all. It has done nothing for my higher good. He said, this dying process makes me understand that it's important to forgive. Forgive him and forgive myself.
Yeah. Well, Becky, they've been a delight to have in the Shame-Free Zone. We are out of time. And I want to let our listeners know once more, the name of Becky Hawkins' book is called Transitions, A Nurse's Education About Life and Death. And it's available both in softcover and digital versions over at LadyHawkPublishing.com. Any final words from you, Becky, about how they might be able to contact you?
Yes, you can find my book also at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. And you can contact me on my website. There's a Contact the Author page, and I would love to hear from anybody that would like to visit with me.
What is your website?
Too.
www.ladyhawkpublishing.com. Oh, okay. That is your website.
Uh-huh.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much, Becky. I really appreciate it. And to my listeners, next week we are going to once again hopefully get Caroline DuPont here. She was scheduled to be here a couple weeks ago, and unfortunately we had a little mix-up because she's on Canadian time, but she's going to be talking to us next Monday about her new book, which is called The New Enlightened Eating. And I'm actually excited to talk to her about some of the shame that we experience around dieting and body image and food choices and things like that. So I hope you'll tune in next Monday for Caroline DuPont and The New Enlightened Eating. Okay, this is it from the Shame Free Zone for tonight. And I have been your and continue to be your host, Veronica Monet. Good night for now.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak muncul kabar berita?